The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. Coming up on the show, how have our attitudes to autism changed since the disorder's first definition in 1943? Technology writer Steve Silberman's new book charts the evolution of autism, from its origins in the shadows of World War II, up to the current campaign to reframe autism as something to be accepted and accommodated rather than eradicated. Steve describes families and adults who have learned to live happily with autism and find its strengths. Also, James Ransom joins us to discuss phase two of the Guardian's Keep It in the Ground campaign, and we talk about this week's latest news, from rat brains to George Ball. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Steve Silberman is an American journalist who writes about technology for Wired magazine and The New Yorker. His new book, Neurotribes, is a thorough study of how autism has evolved. In the book, Steve reveals the perfect storm of social forces that led to the sudden increase in autism diagnoses beginning in the late 1980s. He also highlights some of the most cutting-edge science and innovation that has been wrought by people on the autistic spectrum. Ian Sample talked to Steve and started by asking him what led him to write the book.
In 2000, I was on a boat in Alaska with more than 100 computer programmers. And the event was something called a Geek Cruise, which was an attempt by an entrepreneur to have a tech conference in a place that wasn't utterly boring and dreary. So we're cruising up towards the Arctic Circle, and there were a bunch of very colorful characters on the boat. And one of them was Larry Wall, who invented an open source programming language called Perl. Without Perl, many of the things that we take for granted on the internet would not be possible. Perl is used everywhere, even within Microsoft software. So towards the end of the cruise, when we were arriving back in Vancouver, I asked him if I could interview him at his home in Silicon Valley. And he said, "Yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have a profoundly autistic daughter." And so I didn't know that much about autism back in 2000, like most people. Almost everything I'd learned was from the film Rain Man. So I didn't really think much of it. When I went to interview Larry, I noticed that he had customized the sensory environment of his household to suit someone with very acute senses. So that, for instance, he had replaced the buzzer on his clothes dryer with a little light bulb that would quietly light up instead of startlingly buzz. And so I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Then a few months later, I was writing a profile of another technologically very adept family in Silicon Valley. The patriarch of that family had built the first computer in the Middle East. And when I asked the sister-in-law of the woman I was profiling if I could interview her at home, she said, "Yeah, sure. By the way, we have an autistic daughter." And so I thought, God, that's odd. Two families with a very, very rare neurological condition. I didn't expect to meet an autistic person in my lifetime back then because it was considered so rare. So I was telling this story of this amazing coincidence to a friend of mine in a cafe in San Francisco, and a woman at the next table suddenly blurted out, "Oh my God, do you realize what's happening?" And I said, "What's happening?" She said, "I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children." So the hairs on the back of my neck stood on end. I immediately, because I'm a science reporter, I immediately got the urge to check out her story and dig more and find out what was really going on. And so I ended up writing an article that came out in 2000 for Wired magazine called The Geek Syndrome. It came out the same month that 9/11 happened, so it was actually supposed to be the cover story. It got pushed back, but still the response was tremendous. It made quite an impact. The thing that I noticed, though, was that I kept getting email about it for like 10 years afterwards, which if you've ever written for a newspaper or magazine, you know, is very unusual. That usually articles are like snowflakes. They melt away and everyone forgets them. The letters that I got were mostly about families realizing that once their children so-called aged out of services and supports that are available for children, they were just left on their own to fend for themselves. I also got many letters from autistic people who really wanted to work but were unable to find training programs that would help them enter the workforce. Meanwhile, The whole world was having a very angry argument about vaccines. Basically, every internet comment space was populated by people. You know, some people were saying, yes, it's vaccines that are causing this dramatic rise in estimates of autism prevalence and diagnoses. Then the other side was saying, no, it's not. And then the anti-vaccine side was saying, you guys are shills for big pharma. Basically, nothing would ever get discussed in any internet comment section about autism except whether or not vaccines cause autism. So I realized that people with autism and their families were having an entirely different set of concerns from the concerns of people arguing on the internet. And I started to think there's something wrong. Something's gone wrong here. When I spoke to experts, they explained to me that it was not vaccines, that the diagnostic criteria had been broadened, but there was kind of inert bureaucratic language. So if you're a journalist and you have some guy, you know, from the CDC or something saying, it's broadened diagnostic criteria and better case finding. And then on the other side, you have a mom who's saying, I'm terrified for the future of my, you know, my children and the safety of my children. Who are you going to, you know, pay attention to? If you're a journalist like I am, you've been trained your whole life to give a voice to the underdog. And so the mom basically got, you know, the prominence in the conversation. But meanwhile, autistic people were not, you know, dealing with what caused their autism. They were dealing with the lack of services and supports. So I thought, I have got to try to look at this in depth.
I'm wondering why you called it neurotribes.
Yeah. I wanted to come up with a word that did not automatically pathologize autistic people. And in the book, I write a lot about the clinic of Hans Asperger, who really was the true discoverer of autism, although a guy named Leo Kanner generally gets the credit. But in the 1930s, Asperger really discovered what we now call the autism spectrum. And the founder of his clinic in Vienna, which was a very, very progressive place for its time, was a guy named Erwin Lazar. And he saw humanity as being organized into like clans or tribes, more or less, where each tribe would have sort of a vocation that was their destiny. And he saw it as his job, not as not just diagnosing the children, but figuring out which tribe the child was in so that he could then set them on the right path towards their destined role in society.
I mean, to me, it sounds as if it could be concerning that you're almost sort of pigeonholing people and you're imposing expectations on people very early on.
Well, he was apparently very good at it. The whole clinic was extremely good at coming up with constructive ways of allowing each child to express their maximum potential. So they focused as much on figuring out what the children were interested in and what their aptitudes were as they did on focusing on their deficits and how to correct them. So I actually think it was a very progressive approach.
You talk about Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger, that they seem to have arrived at these kinds of diagnoses at around the same time. Were they describing the same thing?
Well, here's the thing. The standard version of autism history is that Leo Kanner discovered autism at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore in 1943. And then a year later, this guy, Hans Asperger, came out with a paper that's considered a footnote to Kanner's accomplishment. Some people are still arguing about whether or not they saw children with two completely different conditions. People say that Hans Asperger, for instance, saw quote-unquote high-functioning people. I don't like to use that term because I think it underestimates the struggles of people who seem to be functioning well. And that Leo Kanner focused on low-functioning children. None of what I just said is true, even though it is reprinted in thousands of textbooks and Wikipedia. What I discovered was, A, that Hans Asperger had a very prescient view of autism as a spectrum and a condition that lasts through adulthood, which is, in fact, the current understanding, whereas Leo Kanner had a much narrower perspective. He framed it as a very, very rare form of infantile psychosis. He called it early infantile autism. He would eventually blame so-called refrigerator mothers, although he didn't exclude fathers from blaming them as well. That, of course, not only turned out to be wrong, but horrible, because it resulted in the institutionalization of two generations of autistic children. But here's the thing. What no one has known until this book is that those two discoveries were considered one of the great synchronicities of 20th century medicine. People say it was, you know, two independent discoveries. How amazing. The two papers came out a year apart. Anyway, it turns out that Hans Asperger had a diagnostician named George Frankl, and George Frankl was Jewish. In 1938, the Nazis marched into Austria to annex it for the German fatherland, and Jews had to leave in droves or be executed. George Frankl had help to emigrate from a clinician in Baltimore named Leo Kanner. And so Leo Kanner was absolutely heroic in saving the lives of Jewish clinicians. Hans Asperger had another colleague named Anni Frankl, who actually wrote, I believe, the first case history of an autistic person from Asperger's clinic. She also emigrated, and they both were in Leo Kanner's circle. And in fact, Kanner and Frankl would go do these tours together where they would evaluate children for autism. So Kanner was able to borrow the accumulated expertise of years from Asperger's clinic in the person of George Frankl. But then what Kanner did was he never acknowledged Asperger's work ever, except one dismissive reference in the 1970s when he said, oh yes, Asperger, what that person discovered was at best a 42nd cousin of my syndrome and has already received serious attention from investigators, which was not true. The paper hadn't even been translated from German. And people say, oh, well, Kanner just somehow missed it, perhaps because it was in German, which was Kanner's native language. Oh, he somehow overlooked it. Maybe it was because it was in this obscure medical journal, one that Kanner cited many times in his work. So, you know, it's clear that Kanner knew about Asperger's work. I'm sure he read the paper immediately when it came out in German, but he didn't want to acknowledge Asperger's contribution, which turned out to be much more prescient than his own.
We'll get on to what scientists today consider to be, you know, the causes of autism. But at that time, in Kanner's time, and Asperger as well, were they, you mentioned the idea of refrigerator mothers, but were they, did they agree on what the causes may be? Were the causes in their minds all to do with upbringing and so on, or what?
Well, Hans Asperger had an extremely prescient view. He not only saw autism as primarily genetic, because he noticed autistic traits in the relatives of his patients. And in fact, he said something very beautiful. He said that the fact that both the parents and the kids would have autistic traits would give them a basis for understanding each other's experience. That was very profound insight, particularly in the 1930s. He also didn't speculate if there was an autism gene. He speculated that it was polygenetic, as he put it, which it is. We've now identified more than 600 candidate genes and de novo mutations for autism. It's not strictly genetic. There's some kind of environmental role as well. And by environment, I don't just mean something out in the air. I mean like in the womb, because you can have identical twins that are not, as they say, concordant for autism. So one may be autistic, one not, or one may be really profoundly impaired and one not. But so Asperger realized that the primary causes of autism were genetic. Kanner, when he initially published his paper in 1943, did speculate that it was an inborn condition, but then he was sort of pressured into speculating that parents had a role by his colleagues who were coming from a sort of psychoanalytic perspective. And what they told him was that if you say it's genetic, it encourages therapeutic hopelessness. There's no way to move forward with a family if it's a genetic condition. But if you say that it's because of parents, then that puts child psychiatrists like Leo Kanner in an almost unbelievably powerful position, because they can actually intervene and say, no, you should not be raising this child. This child should go to an institution for their own good. And that's exactly what he said. One of the reasons why Kanner and Asperger had such different views of autism was that they had very different missions. The mission of Asperger and his colleagues was what they called remedial education or therapeutic education, i.e. finding a way for the child to grow into an adult and have a happy, successful, engaged, creative life. Leo Kanner was launching child psychiatry as a specialty in America, and he was stressing that it was an empirical science. And so for Leo Kanner, the discovery of this rare form of psychosis that was endemic to childhood was like a boon to the field, because suddenly child psychiatrists would have this tremendously important role. And so he would, you know, literally recommend to families that they institutionalized the child. The problem is that when the children were put in an institution, it's not like there were special autism wards. They were put on psych wards and put in straitjackets and subjected to brutal experimental treatments. So the children not only did not thrive, they withered, and, you know, it was absolutely horrible. And then that degraded state from being in institutions was conflated with the natural history of autism. So people thought autism was a fate worse than death, when it was really institutionalization was a fate worse than death.
And was that a common occurrence, that if you were diagnosed as a child with autism, that you would end up not having some kind of support to live within the family, but you would end up in a hospital?
Oh, absolutely. And it was specifically because of that refrigerator mother theory, although, as I say, it wasn't restricted to mothers. But yes, there was no way. You were considered extremely irresponsible if you didn't institutionalize the child. And not only that, but parents were encouraged to quietly remove their children's photographs from the family albums and never speak of them again, as if they had died.
Why?
Because if you said that you had an autistic child, it was like saying, I am so cruel that I caused a psychosis in my child. And so it became a source of incredible stigma and shame for families, which also had the effect of isolating the families of autistic children from each other. They couldn't reach out to each other because it was that they had done something so horrible. You know, like I write about one of the parents who became very instrumental in creating the autism parent movement in the United States, Bernie Grimland. And the parents were sent to psychoanalysts for years if they had an autistic child, because it was like proof that you were messed up too. And so the psychoanalyst would say to Bernie and his wife, Gloria, why do you hate your child so much? You can imagine, you know, raising an autistic child, particularly in an era with no special education, no support, is hard enough, you know, and then to have the only trusted authorities in your life, like your, you know, the psychiatrist or your pediatrician, feel inside that you had done that to your child. It was absolutely horrible.
How did that idea get buried in the end?
Actually, it was Bernie Rimland. He was a Navy psychologist, but as an amateur, he became obsessed with trying to figure out what had caused his son Mark's autism. And so he started writing what was originally going to be a paper. It turned into a book. A paper or a book by an amateur had, you know, very little chance of being published, but he submitted it to a publisher. It won a sort of a contest. It got published in the early 60s, and that really put away, he basically simply proved that there was no evidence to support the refrigerator mother theory. So he just debunked it, more or less. And so that helped. And then a London researcher named Michael Rutter proved that autism was primarily genetic, as Hans Asperger had speculated, you know, 40 years earlier.
We now talk about an autistic spectrum. I wonder if you could give us some examples of what you see at the extremes of that spectrum and where Asperger's lies on this.
Sure. At one end, there are people who will not ever be able to live independently, who may be extremely self-injurious, may be utterly nonverbal. And by that, I don't mean unable to speak, but can't communicate in any way. So that's one extreme. At the other extreme, you have chatty people who are, you know, the people we all know from pop culture, really, who, you know, computer programmers who are fascinated by Doctor Who.
We're calling it a spectrum. We have a spectrum would have one end and another. At the other end of the spectrum, is that where you would put people who are diagnosed with Asperger's rather than autism?
Yes, or, but I mean, the you know,
these fake distinctions
can,
now.
You can say it's linear, but the woman who invented the spectrum, Lorna Wing, specifically did not think it was linear. Mm. And so she thought of it as points in almost like a three-dimensional field. Mm. The thing to remember is that so-called low-functioning people very often have talents and abilities that are not obvious to the casual observer. So it's not like, you know, people, I think there's a very prevalent misconception. Oh, yes, you have autistic savants, which are these Asperger's people, and then you have these horrible people with, you know, classic autism, and they have, you know, no talents. It's actually, that's not correct. People who find it very, very difficult to navigate daily life, may not be able to get by on their own, often have incredible savant talents like amazing memories or mathematical abilities. And then these, you know, Asperger's people are often really struggling inside, even if it's not obvious. They've learned to script their remarks and, you know, sort of arrange their facial expressions so that they get along with the people around them, but they're really struggling inside, really need help.
Are there common themes, though, to these different points on this spectrum? And what are those?
A difficulty in parsing the subtle social signals that non-autistic people use to broadcast their feelings to one another. So an autistic person may find it very difficult to track the facial expressions of the person they're talking to and figure out if the person is bored or engaged. It may suit them to look away, actually, while listening to what the person is saying. So the neurotypical person is chatting away and thinking, oh my God, this autistic person is not listening to me. Actually, they're listening very hard, but they're looking away. That's also something that Asperger knew. He said that these children learn a tremendous amount about the world through peripheral glances. That was extremely prescient. Meanwhile, Leo Kanner said, you know, they won't pay attention to even their own parents. They're actively shutting out their parents from the world. So Leo Kanner, you know, he did some incredibly heroic things like rescuing the Jewish clinicians, but he also tended to infer sinister motives to both his parents and his patients.
I wanted to know whether you thought that all these different conditions, because they vary in how extreme they are, whether they justify this umbrella term or whether these are actually a collection of quite distinct conditions going on.
Well, the current understanding is that there really is no such thing as autism per se. There are the autisms, which is a collection of very disparate conditions with distinct etiological pathways that create this very distinctive constellation of behavior that we call autism. But autism is just it's a word for a collection of behaviors. It's not like a virus or something you can point to and say, oh yes, that person has autism because there's a biomarker. There is no biomarker for autism. And what will happen now that I've said this is I'll get 10 emails saying, yes, there is a biomarker. Anyway, in every case, that was because someone jumped the gun and said, I found the biomarker. It's too much gray matter, or it's too little white matter or something. And then, you know, 6 months later, that study is debunked. There is no biomarker for autism. It's always based on subjective clinical observation. And it's very subjective and very, I would say, societally constructed. Now, that said, one of the most honest things that a psychiatrist ever said to me was the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the so-called Bible of Psychiatry, he said, the DSM is not about diagnosis. It's about reimbursement. So having an umbrella term for this mass of conditions is very useful for insurance companies and educators and pediatricians and, you know, but, you know, is there one condition? No, it's a mass of conditions.
When we look at the rise in numbers, I mean, I remember over here when researchers came out and said, we think it's probably 1 in 100 now mm-hmm. children being diagnosed. I think in the US, the number is about 1 in 68.
Yeah.
Is that apparent rise? Is it apparent in that this really is just down to extra vigilance for the condition and a broadening of what of the criteria that fulfill that diagnosis? Or is there an increase in the number of people with these behaviors?
Here's the thing. The so-called tsunami of autism, which everyone is constantly talking about, that is exactly what my book is about. And it was not a simple phenomenon because it wasn't just the revision of the diagnostic criteria, which was, by the way, extremely radical. It wasn't like some incremental increase in who would get the diagnosis. It was utterly radical. Also, the entire society changed from passively reporting individual cases of autism to active surveillance of early childhood for potential signs, you know, spot the signs, you know. So the stance of the entire society and infrastructure of pediatricians and educators changed from sort of, oh yes, there might be a case of this rare condition, to everyone's looking at children to spot, you know. So it was completely revolutionary. Not only that, another factor that I consider is Rain Man made the existence of particularly autistic adults apparent to everyone all over the world at the same time for the first time. Parents who had been struggling for decades to have their children recognized as having autism told me that within days of Rain Man's premiere, and of course it went on to win several Oscars, within days of Rain Man's premiere, they no longer had to say, no, my son is not artistic, he's autistic. That, like, after Rain Man, everybody had heard of it. And it produced, you know, a million books, Curious Incident, you know, like a million cultural artifacts came out of that.
You've talked about how it's primarily a genetic condition. What is the thinking now about how this spectrum of disorders comes about, and why do you get things like more of it seen in males than females?
Well, here's the thing. I could run down the list of things that have been listed as possible environmental triggers playing upon an underlying genetic predisposition.
Do we know how much is genetic, first off?
No, but it's a lot. It's considered one of the most heritable conditions in psychology. I could run down the list, or I could refer you to a blog post by Forbes blogger Emily Willingham called This Just In, Being Alive Linked to Autism, in which she actually runs down the whole list of things that have been considered as possible environmental triggers. The problem is, if we focus on that, which, by the way, we do to the tune of millions of dollars of investment a year, we do not focus on the fact that these people need help and their families need support. And so, yes, I could talk about, you know, yes, there's a theory that overexposure to testosterone in the womb. Well, that theory is based on the notion that autism occurs four times more in boys than girls. Is that really true? Geneticists say, well, there's something called a female protective factor that helps protect females from whatever causes autism. We know very little about autism in women. We know very little about how it presents in women. Does it present differently in women than boys? Yes, it certainly does. Is that because of the female protective factor in the genome? Or is that because women are raised very differently? They're raised to be demure and, you know, kind of fade into the background, script their own remarks to suit the feelings of the people around them, whereas boys are rewarded for actually being aggressive, little Donald Trumps, one might say. And so aggressive behavior is often the what calls a child to the attention of the authorities as being autistic. So I think we're just beginning to understand things like, does autism present differently in women? And then we can look at stuff like the female protective factor in the genome.
We need to talk a bit about the vaccination issue. And obviously that whole scare began in this country with Andrew Wakefield's paper and his interpretation of that work. What I was surprised to find from your book and from other places too was that obviously vaccination, we know that vaccination uptake fell, but it's also low, and I think continues to be low, in Silicon Valley, where you would imagine that scientists, well, there would be a lot of people with sort of scientific thinking who would be the ones you would expect to see the value of vaccines and to carry on.
I agree. And I think that a regrettable impulse among sort of the anti-vaccine people is to see them as, anti-scientific know-nothings. Actually, quite the opposite is often true. They obsessively read studies, and they communicate in online forums, and they share information. So actually, it turns out that the vaccine story, with the inconvenient fact of it being incorrect, is actually very believable. You know, because Big Pharma would certainly do, you know, a kind of large-scale conspiracy to cover up, you know, a worldwide epidemic of brain injury. It's completely possible that, the government is lying about this or that. It just so happens, though, that vaccines don't cause autism, as has been proven in many, many different types of controlled studies. So what I tried to do was to make the true story of the rise in diagnoses very understandable to anyone. I wrote for Wired Magazine for a long time. I was used to explaining sophisticated concepts. I had no idea how hard this would be. It took me 5 years to do it, to both collect the information and tell the story. You know, what I hope is that this book, Neurotribes, is the accurate story of autism that is also gripping.
Finally, before I let you go, I wondered if you might share some of the things you've learned about how families help children or other family members who have a diagnosis who are on the autistic spectrum, because I'm sure a lot of people will be really keen to hear what things they may be able to do. And maybe it varies from child to child, from brother to brother, what have you. But Are there common things that work?
Sure. Rather than recommending specific courses of treatment, what I would say is never stop believing in your child's potential, because even children who were very self-injurious, you know, sort of at the beginning of their lives, have turned out to be extremely wonderful people, like Bernie Rimland's son, Mark. Bernie spent his whole life trying to cure Mark, and Mark is a delightful, funny, witty, creative, middle-aged autistic adult. There's also another book I would recommend, actually, that also just came out, called Uniquely Human by Barry Prezant. It's one of the best books for parents. For parents who just got a diagnosis for their child, I would say, look at that, because it's all about, if you see autistic behavior, instead of saying, that behavior is autistic, I have to eliminate that. He says, always ask why. Why is the child, you know, having a tantrum? It may not be just because they're autistic. Maybe there's a fluorescent light in the ceiling that's driving them crazy. And if you put a different kind of light in the room, they'll calm down. So it's really to regard autistic people as people rather than just symptoms of a disorder.
You got a lot of feedback from that piece for Wired that started this all off. What's the feedback been like so far for New York
Times? Well, it's been mostly amazing. I mean, it's a New York Times bestseller. It was just longlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize. So that's good. Of course, I've gotten, you know, tons of hate mail, mostly from anti-vaxxers. And there are also people who misunderstand what I'm saying. Like, there's, because I talk about the positive attributes of autism, and people like Henry Cavendish and geeks in Silicon Valley, some people are saying, you're saying it's not even a disability. No, I'm not. That's the opposite of what I'm saying. It is a profound disability that has aspects of genius embedded in it. And that, I think, is a very, very powerful idea.
Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and How to Think Smarter About People Who Think Differently by Steve Silberman is published by Allen & Unwin. James Randerson joins me to update us on the Guardian's Keep It in the Ground campaign. James, The Guardian has launched phase two of its climate change campaign. But before we talk about that, could you give us a brief recap on phase one? What was its goal, and what were you trying to achieve with that?
Sure. Yeah, well, we launched in March earlier this year, and we were trying to highlight this very inconvenient fact, inconvenient truth perhaps, that 4/5 of the fossil fuel reserves, or somewhere between 4/5 and 2/3 anyway, that we already know about, so the oil, the coal and the gas that's already booked by the companies and owned by governments, has to stay under the ground and not be burned. Otherwise, we have a pretty good chance of going over the 2 degree centigrade warming threshold. Now, you get lots of impacts before 2 degrees, but 2 degrees is sort of seen as a threshold for dangerous climate change, if you like. I mean, the really scary thing about that is that that's the amount of fossil fuel that we kind of already know about. But at the same time, the companies and governments are going out there spending trillions of dollars looking for more, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. So we were trying to highlight that fact. And in particular, we wanted to give a boost to the global fossil fuel divestment campaign. The idea behind divestment, it's a bit like the divestment campaign around apartheid South Africa. It's about institutions, universities, pension funds, philanthropic funds, even individuals taking the decision to move their assets, move their investments away from fossil fuel companies, the ones who are spending that money to go out and look for more fossil fuels that we can't burn, take it out of there and put it somewhere else, preferably somewhere that will contribute to the big shift in the economy that's needed to get away from fossil fuels. And that global campaign, I mean, it's just taken on an incredible momentum in the last few months. It's really astonishing. Over 400 institutions have now made a commitment to divest of one degree or another. And the value in total of the assets that those institutions hold is $2.6 trillion, which I think is a pretty loud statement from civil society.
You were very keen to engage with the public as well. What kind of response have you been getting?
Well, in particular, we had a a petition running. We have a petition running, which was calling on two organisations, specifically the Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust, who are two medical charities, amazing organisations in their own right. But they have this inconsistency in what they're doing, in that, you know, they know the problem caused by climate change, they know the impact it will have on public health. And although they're spending money to try and mitigate that impact, their own investments are effectively contributing to it. So we had over 226,000 people sign that petition. We also, you know, have been in contact with most of those people. We sort of email regularly with updates on the campaign. But importantly, we've also been involving them in the campaign, and they've been really central to it. So, you know, we've had scientists writing to those organizations explaining why they think that they should divest their assets. We've had many readers involved in effectively kind of starring in a video, which was a kind of call to Bill Gates personally to divest, and many other ways. They've contributed ideas for stories that we should report on that we've taken up. So it's been a real sort of two-way effort with the supporters of the campaign, which has been great.
So where are we at with divestment? What's happening with phase one now? We're about to move into phase two. So what's going to happen with the campaign to push for divestment?
Well, I mean, you know, the campaign now has huge momentum, as I was saying, around the world. More than 400 institutions are on board, and that momentum is continuing in the run-up to the crucial UN climate talks that are happening in December. You know, we've heard from negotiators there that they have, you know, felt that momentum, if you like. They've seen this great statement from civil society, and you know, they're taking that on board. It's part of the pressure on politicians, and that's sometimes people misunderstand the point of this. It's not about trying to bankrupt the companies. It's not about saying that, you know, using fossil fuels is in itself, you know, bad or evil at the moment. I mean, that would be ridiculous. We can't stop using fossil fuels tomorrow, but we have to do it over the course of the next 20 years. Otherwise, we're going to be in a really bad place. And so it's about stigmatizing the business models of those companies, the fact that they're out there still spending investors' cash looking for fossil fuels in places like the Arctic and trying to dig up tar sands in Canada and so on, really high carbon sources of energy. And so, yeah, it's about trying to make that unacceptable, really, and to say to politicians, this is unacceptable, you have to stop it from happening. You know, that will continue, and we're not going to kind of stop reporting on divestment because it's now a thing in the world that's happening. But what we're doing is kind of shifting direction. And we spent a while over the summer doing a lot of, again, you know, talking to the supporters, really, a lot of communication with them, saying, you know, which direction would you like us to go in next? You know, we conducted some focus groups about the campaign to see what people felt about it and which direction to go in. Mm-hmm. A couple of messages came back really strongly. I mean, obviously, people had lots of ideas, which was great, but there were a couple of common themes. The strongest one was, I would say, hope. People wanted to hear that there is hope that we're going to solve this. They wanted to see the examples around the world of how things are changing for the better. They felt that, you know, we hear so much about sort of doom and gloom around this subject. The science side of it seems to be unremittingly depressing. Even quite a lot of the corporate side of it, when you read about companies that are deliberately trying to foster doubt on the issue when they've known for some time that the science is very clear, that sort of thing is pretty depressing, you know, when you're honest about it. We took this message and we said, right, okay, phase two is going to be about hope, about shining a light on those projects that are kind of leading the way, trying to sort of get that information out there. The second part of this is, in particular, solar power. We wanted to kind of show the great hope that there is in solar power. The cost has just come down incredibly quickly in the last few years. It's coming down sort of faster than people predicted. There was a computer scientist in 2011 who wrote a blog in Scientific American who pointed out that the cost of solar power is coming down in line with Moore's law, and he predicted that we'd be at 50 cents per watt by 2030. Now, by the end of 2014, we were down to 36 cents per watt. So it's coming down much faster than people expected, which is just changing the facts on the ground and making it, you know, much easier for this transition to happen, which is, you know, really, really important. You know, I think there's a natural sort of transition here from, we were talking about divestment a lot before, now we're talking about investment. Where does the money go to make this transition happen?
And we were talking before about how much the public have gotten involved with this campaign and how much they've put their weight behind what we've been doing here at The Guardian. Can you tell me a bit about how they can get involved with this side of the campaign?
If you want to know more, just go to theguardian.com/keepitintheground. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to read the launch piece, because in it near the top is a little box where you can sign up your email. It's literally just kind of your name and email, and we will then send you information about the campaign as it goes on. Partly we'll be saying, you know, here's this week, this is the really important piece of journalism that we've done. We feel, you know, that, you know, if you read one thing this week, this is the thing to read. But also we'll be asking for your help, giving you opportunities to get involved, which you can take up or not. It's entirely up to you. But if you want to be kept abreast of what's going on, just sign up there, theguardian.com/keepitintheground.
And how does this tie in with the Paris talks? How does that encompass those very important talks that are going to be happening later this year?
Well, it's all part of an effort to turn up the heat, I guess, ahead of that. Around March, it was important to get moving then, because actually a lot of the key decisions were really taking place in kind of June, July, which sounds like a bad thing. It sounds like, you know, they've stitched it up ahead of December or something like that. But actually, it's really important. The problem with previous UN talks was they left too much to the last minute and were not able to kind of get over the line and had to bodge something together at the last minute. With these talks, the French government has put in an immense diplomatic effort around the world. Every single embassy and diplomatic mission has been tasked with talking to their respective government about the topic and to try and get people on board. The signs are that that effort is bearing fruit. A lot is in the bag already. You know, the work around June is sort of paid off. And I think, you know, the part of the divestment campaign, I'm not the Guardian, not saying the Guardian should take credit for all of this by any means, but because the divestment campaign is much bigger than us, and our, you know, it's worth saying actually that our partner on the campaign is 350.org, who are an American NGO who were pushing divestment long before we were. But the fact that that momentum was there, I think, has been feeding in some sense to the politicians. And then this last phase, you know, we've got about 7 weeks or so to go until the talk starts. You know, there'll be all sorts of things happening over the next few weeks that will be turning up the heat and generally demonstrating to politicians that people want something to happen. The climax of that, I suppose, will be a global climate march on the 29th of November, so the day before the talks start. I mean, the biggest one will be in Paris, but there'll also be one in London and in cities around the world. And they're hoping that it will be even bigger than the one that happened in September last year, where around the world there were over 600,000 people marched. They're trying to have a sort of an international show of public opinion, which hopefully will have an impact.
So let's turn to news now. James, you have an interesting story about rat brains.
It's a story about trying to reconstruct a rat brain, or at least trying to reconstruct a very small part of it. I don't mean a physical reconstruction, but doing so within a computer, so a sort of model of a rat brain. I mean, on one hand, it's very impressive because you're talking 30,000 neurons, 40 million connections, 40 million synapses that they've modelled here. And this is based on, you know, real connections within the rat brain. So, you know, there's kind of 20 years of work, if you like, in embodied in this simulation. But it's worth saying on another level, it's very, very simple. I mean, it's, you know, there's all sorts of elements of the brain that aren't here. There's no blood vessels, there's no myelin sheaths, there's all sorts of things about the structure of the brain that just aren't there. And also, it's obviously much, much smaller than a rat brain. I mean, a human brain, for example, is around, you know, 86 billion neurons, 1,000 trillion synapses. So, you know, much, much larger than what they've got here. Nonetheless, what's interesting is they found that this simulation exhibits behavior that you see in a real rat brain. You know, if you sort of tickle the whiskers of this virtual rat, then you see the same sorts of responses in the brain that you see in the real brain of a rat when you tickle its whiskers. You know, it looks like they're plausibly onto something. And it's really the first step in trying to really understand how the brain works by recreating it in that sense.
And what are they trying to do with this? What's the ultimate goal of this project? Because this isn't just about trying to create a sort of digital rat, is it?
No, it's really about trying to understand how the brain works. I mean, you can sort of do all kinds of experiments to make inferences about how a system works, you know, a complex system like the brain. You know, you can knock bits out and see if it behaves how you predicted it to behave, or you can look at brains where bits have gone wrong for whatever reason and you know, try and make inferences about what they were doing from the kinds of outcomes of that. But until you can really build one and see it working from the ground up, if you like, I suppose you can't quite be confident that those inferences are correct, because you just don't know, you know, has something else gone wrong that you weren't aware of? Which of the connections that aren't there are significant? Who knows? You know, so being able to recreate the system is quite significant.
But this isn't a cheap project. There's been sort of estimates that trying to reconstruct a whole rat brain is going to take about, what, 20 billion euros. Is everyone behind this? I mean, it seems like a very expensive way of trying to understand the brain.
That's right. And not everyone is behind it, actually. You may recall there was some controversy a year or so ago about the Human Brain Project, which is a massive multi-group project trying to do similar sorts of things that was funded to the tune of about 100 billion euros by the European Union. You know, the controversy around it was that researchers in other areas of brain research said, well, hang on a minute, that's a hell of a lot of money. You know, we could do a lot with some of that money. And, you know, I think there's some scepticism. I guess there's division within the community about which approach is going to be most productive. Mm. And now, obviously, the costs are going to come down. I mean, you know, to do this, they used IBM's BlueJean supercomputer, which is, you know, an immensely powerful, very, very quick supercomputer. But computing power gets better and cheaper all the time. So one imagines, a bit like the Human Genome Project, that was immensely expensive to start off with, and as they got through it, it got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
Sure.
So that will probably happen in this case, but nonetheless, there are divisions within the neuroscience community about whether this sort of money should be spent on this approach.
And in terms of the work that they've done so far, creating this sort of section of a rat brain, has it told us stuff that we don't already know? I mean, has it sort of yielded new insights, or is it more that they've been able to achieve this and that in itself is quite impressive?
I think it's more the latter. It's a tour de force in its own right. And the fact that the results they got out of it are not crazy, basically, is success. Mm. You know, if they were getting signals out of this that you know, if this rat brain was just behaving completely differently and what it was doing just wasn't making any sense with what we thought we knew about the brain, then, I mean, that would tell you something interesting, I think. You know, it would mean that some of the assumptions that have gone into it are not right and they'd have to re-examine them. But it's not as if all of a sudden we've learned something new about the rat brain. But what we've done here is apparently successfully, in a very simple way, recreated part of the brain, which in itself is pretty impressive. But it doesn't take us that far on its own.
Also this week, we have a story in The Observer about a mathematical pioneer called George Ball, whose 200th birthday it is this year. He was born in Lincoln, the son of a cobbler, and rose to become the first professor of maths at University College Cork. The work that he did actually laid the foundation for our digital age. And Lincoln are about to kick off with their digital festival called the Frequency Festival, and George Ball is going to be playing a pretty pivotal role in it this year.
What's that?
Premiering at the festival, there's a new documentary all about George Ball and his story and his work, which is going to be narrated by Jeremy Irons. And there's also lots of lectures about him. He had a very, very interesting life because his key goal was to try and find a way of getting to the truth of things, whether that was mathematics or whether that was religion or many different topics. He was always trying to apply logic to his life. And basically what he did was he was the first person to apply logic to algebra. And it created a whole new area of maths and eventually basically laid the foundations for what a chap called Shannon later picked up on and used to create logic gates that we have in our computers.
So his work, sort of and
or not, gates. That all came from Ball's work. So it's kind of this fantastic idea that there's this Victorian who obviously had no idea what his work was going to lead to, and yet he managed to do such pivotal work. And what's interesting is that he was quite fated at the time. He was a sort of self-made man. He became a professor at a university in Ireland, but without having a university education himself. So he was a sort of very great role model. But he's sort of fallen out of public consciousness. Obviously, some of his work at the time seemed a bit abstract. People struggled, obviously, to get it into the public consciousness. But now, with the advent of the digital age, we can really see the impact of his work. And Lincoln are keen to put him back on a pedestal in the city. And they are sort of making sure that he's being sort of fated ahead of his birthday on the 2nd of November.
It's an amazing story of a transformation of a life from a very humble working class background.
Absolutely, absolutely. He was quite interested in the way that he managed to sort of propel himself. He managed to educate himself not only in mathematics, but also in languages, in Greek as well. And wow. He basically was a self-taught man. And it's interesting when you read about him, because it seems that he was a real sort of polymath in a way that perhaps we don't have so much these days. And he was really able to apply his reasoning to many different fields and grapple with many different problems, which is just, you know, a fascinating thing. Today we see people being very much focused on a smaller and smaller niche of their research.
Yeah.
And yet he was somebody who seemed to come up with an idea in one field and think, well, how can I apply that to another field? And wasn't afraid to have a go at making those connections, whether or not they were successful.
Now, that's interesting, because one gets the sense that often the great advances in science happen, you know, on the boundaries between two different fields, and often the people who make those advances are somehow able to sort of straddle those two. I'm thinking about, you know, evolutionary biology and Ronald Fisher. You know, he, by bringing some hard maths into you know, the biological realm, you know, just made a huge amount of progress there. And there are plenty of other examples. And, you know, often people say the academic tea room is the most productive place in a university. It sounds like this guy was sort of, embodying that.
Absolutely. And I think the sad thing was he met a rather untimely end. He died before he was 50. I think he died when he was 49. He went to a lecture in dripping wet clothes. He got caught in a storm or something, and he got some sort of fever. Unfortunately, his wife was quite keen on the idea of homeopathy, and so the legend goes, although many declare that she was sort of unfairly maligned in this, but that he was sort of kept in a sick room with windows open and damp sheets to try to treat like with like, and unfortunately it didn't work. But whether that was a story that was spun afterwards, we don't know how much truth there is in that, but that's certainly what was said. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Steve Silberman and James Randerson. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.